No disrespect, but that's how I am.
Welcome back, Level 20, Episode 6, Shanghai 6. I'm Connor Smith, your host, Level 1 Summer Intern. You know the drill. Go watch the movie if you haven't already. Email us questions, podcast@level1productions.com. Tell your friends about the pod. Rate us on iTunes. Go pre-order Romance or check out some of the new items we got. We have new colorways in the three-quarter zip fleece that are super dope, so check those out. Follow us on the gram if you haven't already, at Level 1. Check out the Level 1 newsletter on the Level 1 website. Scroll all the way to the bottom of the homepage for that sign-up. No time to waste. Here we go. Episode 6. Josh and Friedel, back at it. Here we go.
Episode 6.
Week 6. 2005.
Actually, technically the winter of 2004-2005.
Sure.
This is true.
But the movie came out in 2005, and it's called Shanghai 6.
Where's the Shanghai come from?
It came directly from a bonus feature I'd made the prior year called Booyah, which I think we had discussed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I made a little joke that it was like basically like, check out the sequel, Shanghai 5, which is like High Noon. And then there's a movie called High Noon, which is a Western starring John Wayne. They remade that movie with like Will Smith called Shanghai Noon. So,
okay.
It was a super insider, really dumb joke. I was like, check out Shanghai 5. Get it? High 5.
Okay.
And then at some point, I don't know, maybe Josh can elaborate because I don't really remember, but we were like, let's just call it Shanghai 6.
I think we got to a point where we did want to do something with the number 6, and I think we also decided we can name a movie anything we want, and it doesn't really matter. And it was like half a joke. Like, this makes no sense whatsoever. We're going to roll with it. Then I remember after we came up with or committed to that title, we were also going to be working with Neil Satyragopoulos that year. And I mean, that guy was just a wizard with post-production, After Effects, compositing stuff. And partially inspired by what he had done with his movie Wicked. I remember he talked to me, we were like, yeah, well, we could do some sort of like Asian samurai crazy like intros for all the athletes. And you know, that'll tie the Shanghai like concept in. And so I think I recall having meetings with some of our sponsors and be like, that's what it means. And they just kind of looked at me like, okay. Obviously it never went in that direction, not even remotely. But
is the introduction with all the projector shit a little bit of inspired by that, or is that its own thing?
No.
It's entirely its own thing, but it was its own thing to capture Neil's skill set and what he brought to the table, which was, you know, again, just like crazy post-production value. And I was inspired by a lot of what was going on in some of the snowboard films at the time with their intros and putting logos and athlete names on the scenery and the backdrop and buildings and signs and things like that. And just coming up with a creative application rather than putting a title on screen as we had easily done in years past. And
sure. So is all of that projecting stuff, is that all post that Neil did, or is that real?
It's a combination of the two. We actually had a working 100% functional projector that I bought for $50 at some, AV warehouse supply place.
Damn.
And I still have it today in my living room in the dining room on a stool, sort of as a ornamentation of sorts. But
says, I make films. Anyone that enters this house will know that I am a filmmaker.
Oh, it's not as bad as the giant FILM letters that my parents got me like 15 years ago from this really cool antique shop in I guess it was probably in Vermont. And for the longest time, we had those letters in our office. They're originally in Aurora, they moved them to Denver, and then it said MILF, and it said MILF for like the better part of 10 years.
Genius flip.
Yeah. It's too easy. But where were we?
The intro. I remember sitting, because so Neil yeah, had made this cult classic, Wicked, an East Coast film that he spent like almost, I think, 2 years on. And a lot of it was post-production wizardry, which took like more ordinary park shots in the East and street rails and stuff and turned it into like this crazy opus. So he came out hot on the tail of that to Denver the summer of 05. We were both sharing a room and a bunk bed together in the downstairs room at the house. Mm. And we would just drink coffee and get super wired all night. And like, Neil's like actually a crazy genius, but we were like bouncing like, oh, we'll do this crazy intro. And he was like scripting out like a snatch style, like acting and like crazy things. And I think Berman was like, yeah, let's dial it back a little, boys. Like, let's make this something we can actually film in, like, you know, realistically. Because Neil gets way ahead of himself with ideas, like, in a good way, but it's ill as fuck. But some of it's, like, not really.
Also in a way that we'd have to shut down operations for 6 months to shoot this crazy intro that everybody would watch one time and then skip.
But we did. I mean, everybody that could came out to Denver that August to film for this intro, including Dave Crichton, Liam Downey, who else?
Oh, Dan Marion.
Luke Van Valen.
Yep.
Craig Coker.
Yeah, I think so.
Travis Redd.
Rainville.
Rainville. Yeah.
Damn, that's definitely like a new direction for the behind the scenes, how seriously you guys are taking the concepts of how you're putting the movie together to have people fly out and film an intro.
You know, we wanted to differentiate what we were doing beyond just capturing the ski action and try to make something a little different.
Word.
But I think once we did scale it back, it was still this loose concept of Tanner Rainville kicks it off with like grabbing this projector from somewhere and just like runs it down the railroad tracks and then just like sets it up. And all of a sudden it projects a Dinastar logo. And
classic projector caper, if you will.
Who stole the projector?
Yeah. Driving around in this red T-100. That's our buddy Dave Boger's truck.
Mm. Yep.
And then
he recently sold that. That thing lasted for like 14, 15 years with him. More, longer.
Yeah.
Damn. Intro leads into Corey Vanular opener. A lot of, as you put it last week, Friedel, greasy shots. Something that stuck out to me was he does, it's like an on-off on a roof where he does like a very noticeable but like not so noticeable tail press like across the whole roof to 180 out.
Early manual, circa December 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that you can see the genesis of these ideas of bringing in like the skate tricks and whatnot into skiing, and they were definitely being held back by ski technology at the time, because the Dinastar Troublemaker, which was the hot ski that a lot of people in this movie are on,
stiff as a board,
is stiff, and it's a narrow little mogul ski, essentially. It doesn't even remotely resemble what we would consider a modern day park ski, and certainly not like a Line or an ON3P that has like crazy twang on it where you can really dip into those. So
yeah,
yes, that is like people are pressing and all that stuff. Now
look, he's leaning back with all his body weight, and tips are riding like an inch off the surface.
Yeah, that's, and they're not even probably even center mount anyway. No. So it's like, yeah, but there's these things that are starting to, little flickers of the future of that type of skiing.
Yeah, because clearly the inspiration was there for like, oh, I'm going to try to wheelie across this whole roof.
And nose butters, tail butters, into stuff, etc. Because at that point, in my opinion, rail skiing was starting to get really boring, like stagnant. And in this movie in particular, I really noticed that there's just a lot of people sliding rails to either forward or switch. That's kind
of it. Sometimes too. One of the things that really stood out to me at the time, Vanler was one of the first people that I saw do some proper pretzels, two sev on, two sev off the back way. And there's a contest in Frisco, Colorado, some sort of night rail jam session associated with the U.S. Open that year. And Vanler does a whole bunch of different 270 combinations punctuated with that two set pretzel. And I mean, that was one of the first times a lot of people had seen something like that.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal.
It was a big deal. He was definitely the first. I know Hornbeck was right on his toes with that. I think they were battling over who was really getting that first proper pretz, maybe. But yeah, so it was like in rail skiing and street skiing and whatnot, it was kind of like, well, we got to this point and now like there's these little flickers of innovation beyond that, just like getting these rails or whatever.
Sure. So,
Was the technology holding people back in a similar way in the POW skiing? Because most of these segments have POW and street.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Definitely. There was some decent POW skis, like Vocal had one, maybe Solomon had one, but I don't know. And maybe Armada did too, but.
But even at that point, we're talking like the pocket rocket from Solomon and things like that, that, you know, there's not any early rise to speak of. And I mean, it's definitely a far removed ski from.
Yeah. These are fully cambered skis that are stiff and not wide at the waist. So different era of that. And you can see like it took years, man. Yeah. It was like, and it was ski technology and companies catching up to what people were trying to do.
At that point, I think part of the problem was that if you look around by comparison in 2019, how many small ski brands are there that have the ability to turn out a product very quickly and do a lot of experimentation in these little presses that they've got in a warehouse, in their garage, whatever. And 15 years ago, the people making skis were the Dinastars, the Rosignols, the Solomons, the Vocals, and the pace at which they could move to make a new mold and come up with an idea and actually execute it. If
they even had interest to begin with.
Yeah, only if. And I remember it was right around that time. Might have even been that very year I went over and visited the Dinastar factory for the first time. And I remember they led us into their back room where they're building molds. And it was like top secret, like, don't record any video in here. And I mean, not that there was anything for us to like really see or take in or share with anybody.
Crazy IP.
But yeah, they considered it, you know, they had this 70-year-old dude who'd been building their ski molds for 50 years. And, you know, this man was the one who designed all the skis. Like, this guy has no idea what skiing switch is, what landing switch is, what these kids are trying to do. And I think that was very similar to what was going on with all the major ski brands at the time. And it definitely was holding everybody back.
Yeah, noticeably, for sure. You can really see it.
Yeah, I mean, most of the step down and natural hit cliffs in the backcountry that you see, all of the landings, they ride out of so slow because you just bomb holing into the snow because you have nothing to land on. Yeah.
Very true.
Segment after that, Travis Red. Interesting to hear that you think the rail skiing was getting stale, Friedel, because I was think there are some rail spots in this movie that are progressive in
dope spots.
Yeah.
But
like the 8-kink Travis opener.
That was on the poster.
Yeah.
I mean, that was probably like a highlight spot.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, things like that were happening. But there's a lot of like down rails.
Yeah.
That are like,
I think at that point people were becoming a lot more comfortable with what they could do on basic rails. And we're starting to figure out that we can do these longer rails, these more technical rails. And it wasn't so much about tricking them as taking on these challenge rails, if you will. I think that to speak to Friedel's point, I don't think that it was necessarily getting stale, but it was reaching a limit at what street skiing reasonably was with drop and ramps and pole whips and, you know, what was going on at the time. I think it really, it took that next step of getting winches into the picture and really opening up, you know, a whole new approach to what you could do in the streets, which fast forward a couple of years and we'll get there. But I think that was a lot of what was going on, is we're just, you know, reaching the limits of, you know, what you can do with these very limited speed resources.
And just like, I mean, the people were doing stuff with style and trying to make all these like more simple slides look good, but there was not any of the presses going on or anything like that either. Cause I remember like Dave Crichton and very specifically trying to tail press on this down bar, and it just wasn't really happening. So
I noticed that ideas, one today. Like, yeah.
But, and like people trying stuff, but it wasn't fully happening. And then, you know, there's a couple of like the, like Vanilla has a small 2-sev on and the Crichton has both switch lips and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know. It's like, it was a in-between point from like breaking through with like tons of street skiing to it be kind of becoming just like, yeah, a bunch of people are hitting rails and like doing it really nice. There's kind of like an in-between zone. In my humble opinion.
Where was that, E-Kink?
That was Duluth, Minnesota. That was our first street trip there. I remember we had originally planned on going to Ohio. And at that point, I had linked up with Kyle Decker. I think, I think it was the premiere of High Five. That was when I first met Kyle Decker, actually. So quick rewind to that season. So it was the fall of 2004, right before, sorry, the fall of 2005, right before we started shooting for Shanghai 6. And a shop in Ohio that Kyle Decker worked for offered to fly me out for the weekend to go hang out and put on this premiere. And, you know, I'd never been offered an opportunity like that. And to me, I mean, that was like semi rock star status. Like, hell yeah, I'll come out. And I remember actually it was Kyle Decker and Chip Callback who were part of this little group called OFS, Ohio Freestyle. I think that's OFS Media. Ohio Freestyle Media. And they showed up at the airport picking me up in matching hats and hoodies. I'd spoken to them on the phone, exchanged a few emails, but I just knew one was Kyle and one was Chip. And these guys were borderline twinning at that point. And it definitely took me at least 24 hours to know who was Kyle and who was Chip. I was a little overwhelmed. But we went to this premiere of the bar and ended up hanging out with those guys all weekend. I do remember being around for when we set a couch on fire in the middle of the street outside their the place they were staying. There were just like hundreds of kids, like college kids. This is outside of Kent. Just going nuts and just like super loose college parties. It was a good time. Somewhere there is a video from way back when of this couch like on fire and this dude is like doing donuts around it or something like that in a Camaro. And it's like,
damn, that is as Ohio as it gets right there. That's Midwest AF right there. Camaro doing donuts on a burning couch.
Yo,
it was pretty insane.
It should be on the license plate.
But I had met some girl that weekend and kicked off some weird long distance relationship with her, and I wanted any excuse I could come up with to go back to Kent. So I was like, let's go shoot rails in Kent. So we all rallied there and it was just pouring rain. There was no snow. I think there were a couple shots of Liam Downey on a down flat down that we shot, and it was like, this is the end of the line. There's nothing left here. And I think we even maybe put a post on New Schoolers or something like that. Just putting out feelers like we're in Ohio. Where can we go? Where is there snow and handrails and a street scene? And this dude by the name of Andrew Featherstone and a couple of his buddies from Duluth, Minnesota hit us up and they're like, we'll tour you around. There's plenty of snow, plenty of features. This is the spot. And so we just jumped in my car and drove up to Duluth. And I think John Spriggs flew in. I had Craig Coker and Travis with me. And I guess Liam had to go somewhere else or something.
Must have switched it up.
Yeah.
But he came out to Utah with me or something like that.
Yeah. But anyway.
Had you known of anyone else, skiers or snowboarders, who had gone to Minnesota to do a trip?
At that point, absolutely not. I mean, that was, the concept of rail trips. I mean, nobody else was really doing that. Certainly in skiing, I assume, the snowboard crews were probably already on it.
They were absolutely on it.
Yeah. But as far as like ski crews, like there weren't other pro ski crews with travel budget, if you will, or, not that we even had much of anything, but.
It was starting to happen. We were breaking out of like the normal. We were going on.
Getting off the struggle bus.
Yeah. And we're just looking for new fertile ground, like looking for new spots. In Shanghai 6, if nothing else, opened up a lot of new zones. Like a big time Ontario presence, and as well as Duluth. Like there's so much stuff from Duluth.
Yeah, I mean that was super,
because that quad kink ledge is crucial. There.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it was
still to this day, Duluth is a spot. To
that's what I was. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Is like there was a level one crew there this year. There's been other crews there this year, going back a decade now. Like that's the spot to go film rails. So well, it's wild to hear like about this first trip.
As far north as in the lower 48 as you can get. That place stays damn cold. Gets snow.
Semi-industrial city on a huge hill. I mean, it has all the ingredients for shooting street.
Dope.
And Josh brought out his brand new jib arm.
The boom.
The big boom.
The boom. It was like the drone of 2005.
Except I was the only one doing it.
Yeah.
I think I first saw that in a BMX edit, and I'm forgetting like who the kid was that I was talking to about it, but anyway, I invested in this boom, which I had to keep in a huge ski bag and break down. It's probably like a half an hour setup every time I put the thing up.
That's wild.
You had to weight it with
the
like
counterbalance weights were very heavy.
Yeah,
barbell like style,
50 to 100 pounds of weights depending on your setup, and it was a massive undertaking, but like, you know, it definitely.
This sounds like a huge pain in the ass to set up on like a resort setting, of which there are several park shoots that have this on. But to bring this to a street spot and to be like, yo, we're going to go hit this handrail at night and I'm going to set up this boom is like kind of nutso.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways it was. But well, it got even crazier the next year because I got one of these pan tilt like motion control things that I attached to it, which effectively was like a 3-person setup to actually operate properly. But of course, I'm always by myself. So I'm trying to do this thing and it was so janky.
It's like something they use at NASCAR with like a 5-man crew.
Yeah. And here I am trying to do it in the streets of Ohio. We actually went back that next year, I remember. But we'll get to that. But yeah, I was definitely biting off more than I could chew. But I also knew that every time I got a shot with this thing, it was unlike anything that we'd ever seen before.
Dynamic movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know that none of the snowboard crews were even doing it at this point. Mm. Like were they using a boom?
MacDog himself was a gearhead and he had a crazy boom, maybe a 20 footer.
Oh, that's right. Yep. Yep. But that thing was huge. That was another deal entirely. Yeah. They weren't using that in the streets. That was at a couple park shoots.
Yeah. But I mean, they were bringing that in and they kind of popped the cherry on the dolly too, which is
we'll get there. I mean, that was
2008.
Like, absolutely. I mean, when they did, what was that movie?
Picture This.
That absolutely blew people's minds and opened up a whole new world of an approach to action sport filmmaking. We'll definitely cross that bridge in another couple episodes. But
2005
year,
definitely is like the era where I think we're like, okay, how do we, like, skiing is progressing, if you will. Like, how do we progress filmmaking or whatever? So
weird.
It's clear, evident watching the movie. That's like that. There's a next step with like film cinematography.
So after 5 years of shooting on VX2000s, you guys switching up the cameras this year?
Yeah. So I was paying a lot of attention to what was going on with Sony at the time, and I was a huge fan of their camera systems, and they came out with something called the FX1, which was the first 1080i, well, I'm going to call it maybe true high-definition camera.
Mm. It said HD on it, so it had to be
true. It had to have been, and they charged a whole bunch of money for it, so... Yeah, I mean, but what this thing did is it put a digital signal onto tape and recording 1080 interlaced pixels in width and, in height. It was 1920 by 1080. But actually, really, if you want to go tech, it was 1440 by 1080.
Yep.
And it did this weird stretch thing. Anyway, it was like a super like early version 1.0 of what became an HD camera.
Mm.
And we went out, or I went out and picked up a couple of these things. So like, Friedel, this is the next step.
Well,
no,
I don't know. Well, yes, but what my end of the thing is that I was going to buy a 16 millimeter camera. So I was going to buy Cody Razig's, our friend Cody Razig, who was a filmer for Poor Boys Production back in the day. And then he had and then moved on to Free Screen Magazine as a photo editor for a period. But he had a classic 16 mil setup, an R-Flex with like two lenses. And
still that was the gold standard in that shit.
Dude, so such a classic 16 setup. Like just looking at an RFX body is like screams like vintage 16, old school ski movie gold. But that was my dream, shoot film, buy an RFX. That was just like what you did. I got a loan out for $4,000 to buy this kit from Cody. And I was literally like, the same day I was going to like wire him money or something for this cameras kit, Josh called me and was like, save that. Don't buy that fucking 16, dude. He's like, he's like, Sony's dropping an FX1 in like November. Mm. And this is probably in September or October, probably October. I want to say it's October 2004. So he's like, just trust me, dude. Like, just, it's the same amount of money. Just buy the digital camera. And I was kind of heartbroken because I had my, it was totally like a romantic dream to have this RFX 16mm. Yeah. And within reach, I mean, literally pulling the trigger on it.
Right.
So I called up Cody and I was like, dude, like, I think I'm going to buy this brand new HD digital camera. And he was like, fuck, man, whatever. Like, he was like, damn it. I was like, dude, you'll have no problem selling that camera. But I mean, yeah, deep down I was heartbroken, but also like the prospect of this new HD was exciting as shit too. So I put in the pre-order. I had the $4,000 from the loan in my hand. So I put that towards the pre-order and the camera came in early December. So it was like just in time to film.
There were a number of just in time moments that year with cameras and technology, because the funky thing about shooting with these new cameras is that there was no way to watch the footage on a computer or to import it or to actually edit it. So we knew
what?
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. I mean, we're all editing on Final Cut Pro at that point. And this was a new format that nobody had ever worked with before. And Apple definitely took their time in figuring out how to make this footage workable. And I think there was an announcement when Sony released the camera that's like, this will be Final Cut compatible in the future. So we're like, oh, I hope that means in the next few months. And what actually ended up happening, we went the entire season without being able to either download, backup, or watch anything unless we're doing playback in camera. And of course, you're not really doing playback in camera at the time.
I did watch some stuff. I remember plugging it in with RCA cables into a television one time, and I was like, damn, that does look pretty good. Like, that's clearly HD compared to watching VX.
Well, it was a huge step up for sure. But anyway, I mean, we were always concerned about doing any kind of playback, at least I was, because if you get a banger shot, everybody wants to watch it and watch it like 10 times.
Yeah, and it's still running off a tape, right?
And there is always that risk of messing up your tape.
Sketchy.
Yeah.
You never run those over the wheels as minimum times possible.
Yep. And I definitely heard stories about people in other crews watching stuff on a tape like 10 times in a row, and then all of a sudden they go to like pull that shot off and there's a glitch in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, man, we're never going to let that happen. So anyway, I personally didn't do any playback all year. Maybe once or twice, but didn't abuse the system. But yeah, I remember just in the nick of time, it might have been like May or June, they did a Final Cut update, and all of a sudden we could import this stuff. And yeah, it was a whole new world.
Yeah, I remember like going on the very first trip I did that year to Ottawa, Canada, and we're filming this wooden down flat down. I just looked at the shot the other day. It's the reason I remember this, but there's a shot of me like throwing into just selfie mode and being like, we just got our first clip at high definition, baby. Pretty funny moment. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on how that high def image looks now?
I mean, I ended up using that camera for 4 years because
I think we all did.
You dipped into the EX1 sooner than I did.
Okay.
A year earlier. But 2007.
Well, either way, it was definitely a considerable step up from standard just SD.
Yeah.
720 by 480. I mean, they're talking a lot more pixels. There were definitely some kinks to work out with that camera. And moreover, with our post-production process, for those of you that have ever popped in a Shanghai 6 DVD and watched it at home, you got to turn up your brightness on your TVs in order to make it look decent, because that movie is dark. It's really dark. I think it was
not in like an emotional what sense.
Yeah.
No, in like a picture brightness
sense. As in it's
sense.
Like black in a lot of places.
Yeah. So it was definitely partially to blame the camera and the ability of the camera to pick up lows and highs at the same time. The dynamic range, if you will, is probably limited to like 3 stops or 4 stops or something like that. Compared for just for reference, I think the res we're shooting with now are 14 stops of dynamic range. So huge difference. But yeah, it especially makes things challenging when you're shooting in the snow, of course, because you often have really dark trees and really bright white snow. So you've got both ends of the spectrum in a lot of the content that we're shooting. But we were just about done with the editing the movie. And I was doing some sort of rudimentary color grading at that point. Not that I was any expert at all, but I knew how to make the images look better than when they came out of the camera. However, towards the end of the line, sitting there with Neil Satyricopoulos, and we're watching on my external monitor, which was like a shitty TV that we had in my kitchen at the time that we just plugged in.
Mind you, at this point in time in the post-production, no one had slept for, like, no one, everyone is fried.
Yeah,
like messed up fried.
Yeah,
this is a bad year for editing.
Yeah. Well, that's because we spent all summer shooting all these intro things, and really, I mean, that's it was like this extra thing where we're shooting every single week. We have another athlete coming out, and we're shooting another thing.
And then Neil was coding websites all night. It was like he didn't sleep. He slept like 2 hours a day for a month. Or yeah, Jesus. Pretty much.
Lots of Canadianos.
Oh man,
but. Anyway, sitting there with Neil, and he's like, man, like, it is way too bright. And I'm like, huh? He's like, when we put this on a DVD and people watch this at home, it's going to be way brighter than the image you're looking at on your monitor right now. And I'm like, oh, shit, Neil. Yeah. Okay. Let's make the whole thing really dark. So I spent another day or two dropping the brightness on pretty much everything. And what it did was crush the blacks to the point where you know, you can't see any definition in a lot of these trees. Everything is just black. And then, of course, half the intro is shot at night, or the entire intro is shot at night. And anything that's on the darker end of the spectrum is so black, you can't even tell what the fuck is going on. But ultimately, Neil got things completely bass-ackwards. And what he
just
meant...
Just like a dyslexic moment or whatever.
Yeah, what he meant to say, or probably should have said, is that in reality, everything will look darker on people's TVs than what you're looking out here. And so what I had done... initially was fine, but I spent 2 days just absolutely screwing myself. And when we got these DVDs back, I think I don't even know if we got like a test DVD or what the deal was or when it first. No, you know what it was. This was it. That was the first year that they had the meeting in Aspen, Colorado.
Yeah.
And I went up to the meeting, and I mean Aspen, no surprise, like their venue for screening movies is absolute top of the line. It's the Wheeler Opera House. It's, you know, always top-notch projectors, sound, and everything's just the most beautiful presentation you could ever hope for. And watching this movie, you couldn't see half of the action to the point where...
In a cinema setting. Like,
yeah. To the point where, you know, there are normally things that I'd hope people would react to in the crowd and start screaming and yelling, and there's just, like, silence. And I'm just like, what the fuck? And I ran back. I might have even been like in the middle of the movie to the projector room. I was like, what is going on? Like you like screwed up the projector setting. It's like, no, like this is the same settings we use for everything and everyone. And this is fine. Like your DVD screwed up. I was like, oh man, like yeah, this DVD got screwed up. Oh, that's what it is. And then I remember like went right back down to Denver and then like popped another DVD in. And
the diagnosis process took a little while. We didn't know right away.
Yeah.
What had happened.
But it was brutal. And
I remember running over to Drago's house with the DVD test DVD after we had come back from the meeting and like thrown in. And I was like trying to find anyone with a DVD player and a TV to see what it looked like on different monitors.
Yeah.
I was like, I think it looks all right. Like I was like, and I think he had a brighter TV. And I was like, dude, I don't think it's total. Like, because we were wondering if we should, like, put a halt to this DVD production, maybe, which was, like, fully in effect. Like, it would have been a costly thing to reverse.
Many,
that.
many thousands, not tens of thousands.
So Josh was, like, I think, like, going to maybe pull the e-brake, but maybe, like, probably not if we had any glimmer of hope that it was okay.
Yeah.
And it was like, dude, I think it's passable. And especially if you turn the brightness up on a TV, it looks fun.
Yeah.
So like, end of the world, like, it's going to save us thousands of dollars to reprint DVDs that we can just literally tell people to turn the brightness up on televisions.
Yeah. And so what I did for all the premieres that I went to that fall, and I used to go to a lot of the premieres back in the day, I would personally calibrate these projectors. And in some of these venues, like bars, you'll have screens all around the bars. And I'd get there super early and I would run around and I would crank the brightness on every single one of the TVs in the bars. So when it came on, it would actually look passable. And to this day, I think we got a couple comments from customers like, something's wrong with this. And it's like, just turn the brightness up. It's like, it'll be cool. And they're like, oh, yeah. All right. Yeah, that's fine. And so ultimately, it wasn't the end of the world like I thought it was. But I did lose a lot of sleep. And that was one of the moments where I'm like, we're fucked. Like, I have put all the money that I have and then some into this run of DVDs, which I think at that point was tens of thousands of dollars because we were getting a lot of DVDs made. And it's like, if I can't afford to rerun this, I think that's what it came down to, is I could not come up with money if we had to rerun it.
Right.
And
yeah.
So it was just a cost prohibitive situation. I'm like, man, people are not going to buy this. Like, word is going to get out. It's going to be all over New Schoolers that this is like unwatchable. And I remember speaking to Mike Douglas, probably on the phone at that point, because he was just dipping his toes a little deeper in the pool as a filmmaker. And he was really considering getting one of these cameras. And he's like, oh yeah, Berman, like, I was going to get one of these cameras and I saw your movie and those cameras suck. It's like, yeah, they're those cameras.
Yeah, those cameras, dude.
But they weren't great. It was a beta technology or whatever. But
sure.
I think that's when we fully, because back to my story, like about the 16, like to me, like in my mind up to that point, you know, years into this, still in my mind, if you were a professional cinematographer, you shot in 16 millimeter and this broke that mold. Mm. And I think for level one, that's where level one comes in as an innovator. Like, I wanted to start advertising like level one is like a high definition digital film. Which I think you were a little reluctant to. I think you didn't just want any sort of association necessarily, but it was like, because everyone was like a 16 millimeter film or all this stuff. And I was like, fuck that. We should just be like, start to own it.
VHD.
Yeah. VHD.
It's so, the new wave.
I mean, obviously.
Track pants and all.
But it was still a weird, it's not too long ago, but there was like that time of when like, it's like, is digital like as good as film or whatever? But
right.
It's funny to look back now because obviously there's like, it's a very different thing. But anyway, enough about
the tech stuff.
Rainville, Tanner Rainville, the introduction to his segment has a bunch of combination of stuff we've been talking about. It has that Quad King concrete ledge from Duluth. It has.
He was in the.
Oh, right. The transition. Excuse me. That's the end of Travis's.
Was it Spriggs or Travis?
Yes. Spriggs, Travis,
Spriggs,
or Coker.
Spriggs's pants fall off.
Right.
And
leads into
Tanner Rainville.
Rainville being animated, standing next to his name under an underpass.
Yep.
Lot of movies Tanner Rainville has been in. Some things that stuck up from his segment. A couple really nice follow cams, like, in the park. Not to talk about more tech shit, but, like, it's cool to see how that is progressing through the ages, because there's some much shakier stuff in the early days compared to some smooth stuff in his segment.
Yeah, I think that was just me skiing handheld, just soft hands.
A Keystone with a grip handle camera.
Yeah, like, right. Skate style. So I'm like one hand on top, one hand on the bottom, and just supple camera.
Soft elbows.
That's the way you did it, though. You had to ski nice and smooth. And, but I mean, park setting, easier to do it there for sure.
For sure.
But that's a highlight of the film for me, is Tanner's clips on those in general. That, like, this is T Rain's like quintessential, man. Just like schooling that up bar. Mm. Like, what? He did like
8-10
up 4
Japan,
up 6
yeah
8-10 whatever like
yep
and then
with the Japan yeah. maybe there's a mute on one on the 2-7 like
yeah like tweaking spins off a rail which is highly ill.
And the features in that park shoot taking a step up from what Level One had done in previous park shoots too.
Yeah, well that year definitely was our first ever exclusive custom built park shoot. Where
and no more Parkosaurus, no more Super Park.
Yeah, that was a big transition. Where all
closing
of, a sudden,
of that chapter, kind of
those two things went away, and that was where we got our park shoot fix. I mean, that's where all the athletes and all the film companies got their fixes, and that marked a huge change in the direction of film companies building these resort partnerships and doing things on their own. Which, for us being based out of Denver, the park scene was hot in Colorado. I mean, Keystone and Breck and Copper. And even Vail at the time, you know, those were big time park scene spots, and everybody was keen to promote what they were doing. And Keystone in particular, they had this whole zone called A51, which still stands today as a really great park.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't remember. Actually, I do. It all came through Julian LaMarche.
Yeah, you had already sort of planted the seed the year before.
Absolutely. Well, we showed up at the end of the year when Peter Lenick brought us to shoot on the school bus rail. And it's like, yeah, well, Keystone is really down with this. And yeah, we did the free skier Jib Fest with them too. And Julian was like, yeah, man, you guys should come. We'll build you whatever you want and it'll be great. So we had athletes fly in from all over the world, and we had probably 15 to 20 of our guys there. And every morning we'd wake up at like 10 a.m. and jump in a yellow snow cat at the bottom, cruise up to the park and session until the ski patrol reached their max hours for the day and we had to shut her down.
So you designed that giant butter box on off.
Yep. I did that. And then
it's like the monolith.
Yeah, it is. It is.
2001 Space Odyssey.
And it's funny because it wasn't, you know, I'd refer to that now as a butter box. In fact, I put that same design in front of one of our resort partners this year, testing the waters to see if we could redo it. Because I think something like that, true butter box style in 2019, would go off. But
right.
But yeah, anyway, that concept. And then the we call the four corners jump, which was two takeoffs and two landings. That was another one of my designs.
So it kind of looks like it has a channel in the middle of it.
Yep,
it's a transfer gap with a double channel.
Yeah.
Going horizontal, yep. Vertical.
So yeah, I mean, they built a huge pile of snow with a really wide takeoff and a really wide landing. And then they put a cat channel through the middle going up and down and then one left to right.
Mm.
And pretty crazy sudden, jump.
Yeah, really crazy jump. Mm-hmm. And it, the whole idea was that you could take each takeoff to either of the landings. And the vast majority of people would go left takeoff to left landing, or really it was right takeoff to right landing. I think I had a better in run, but T-Rains, was he the only one to make the transfer? He went right takeoff cork three off mute, right takeoff to left landing.
Who else is hitting it?
Colby West hit it. Liam Downey hit it. Liam had some really sick sevens. Craig Coker and Luke Van Valen both did some huge sevens over the thing.
Yeah, but Rainville drifted that transfer, which is gnarly, corner to corner.
Yep, only one, I think.
That was the year that the Dynastar team like was hot, like full-on Apex.
First time I've ever heard those words.
Totally, dude. It's a different scenario now.
A different era entirely.
But
yeah.
Like they had hot riders back then, and they had coming in with like the three fills and et cetera, but then Crichton was an extension of that, and I think he had just gotten his pro model this year with them. And Josh Novotny, who, if you remember, the balance in second generation.
Oh, yeah.
The dude drinking LaBoss in the bathtub. Mm-hmm. And
old friend of Berman. And he, rad dude, Josh Novotny, he was the team manager. He was hired as the U.S. team manager this year. So he beefed up like Tanner Rainville's presence on the team and
Dan Marion, Corey Vanuler,
Liam Downey. Like, yeah, Corey Vanuler. Like that year, I think they won the Arage Masters, which is the team competition. And it was like a hot ass team. Mm. Yeah, Vanuler, Rainville, Downey, Marion, et cetera. And then they brought in like Loic Cologne-Poton, Marie Martineau from France. So there was like, yeah, I just think of like watching Shanghai Six and the park shoot and stuff and some of the backcountry, like especially T-Rains and those guys, like, damn, what an era for Dina Star.
Yeah.
And then they pulled out completely from any sort of, yeah, I think Navani had that job for maybe 2 years and then everything changed there. And
yeah, they burned it down.
Yeah, they did.
The house burned down.
Yeah.
Marie has one of the most memorable clips in the movie. Crash on some sort of step up.
Oh, yes, she sure did. So we went to Silverton, Colorado. It was Marie. It was, I want to say, John Sims and Stephen Thomas. And who else was with us? Dan Marion. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so at that point we were...
Austin O'Malley.
Yep. We were poking around in the backcountry and really were limited in where we could go and what we could do because I had a sled and maybe one more person in that crew had a sled, maybe even not. I might have had the only sled.
Stefan did.
Okay. So we had two sleds and five people.
Not a great ratio.
Terrible ratio. but I mean, at that point, our sleds could comfortably tow two people.
Mm-hmm.
And
you weren't going very far.
No, I mean, that was what dictated is like, we couldn't go very far. So what mountain pass can we drive up and park on the side of the road and then sled people to that's like within 5 minutes and that we're not going to get stuck or we're at least going to be able to manage the terrain, which was a huge thing. Yeah. And so Red Mountain Pass, Silverton, Colorado.
That's actually Zippermouth Pass in Zippermouth, Colorado.
All right. Just edit that out. Anyway. But so that place that we went that year was super easy access. And we're all still figuring out how to build jumps into the right tranny with the right distance.
Mm-hmm.
And, somebody eyed up. I don't think I want to take credit for it, but somebody eyed up this step up situation that was going to be super high speed. And we probably spent 2 days building this because step ups were if you could find a spot to actually do a jump like that, that would be super low impact. And these guys could actually do the tricks that they were comfortable doing was an ideal scenario. So we had this
like
thing
the
up.
One that Tanner Rainbow does in a different place in Colorado.
Exactly.
A little more user friendly. Super nice. Yeah.
Sure.
Still to this day, like a great style of jump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This
was like, hold on for dear life, get all the speed you can.
Cuckoo
and then like
Coca Puffs version.
Bottom out in the flats and instantaneously you're hitting this like 14 foot tall, super steep wedge that's putting you up on this flat zone of this cliff. And it actually kind of looks like a face if you're going to back through it. I think we called it like the face step up or something. But yeah, there are a couple holes for eyes and a few of the guys hit it and managed to get up reasonably well. And then Marie's like, I'm into it. I'm going to hit it. And it's like, yeah, you go, girl.
Marie's like, a tough chick.
Yes.
She's like,
clearly.
Yeah.
She can hang. Like,
dude, she can totally hang.
No doubt. So Marie ends up, I don't know if she wanted to go for a backflip, but that's just kind of what happened.
It looks like she just loads her tails.
No, there's no way she went. That had to be a straight air.
Probably. Okay. So most likely Marie's going for a straight air, just trying to survive this thing.
Because I think she could have done a backflip.
Yeah.
But that's a classic compression, high speed compression move right there.
Yep. You're right. So that's probably what happened. And she just like sits down on her tails and feet go flying out in front of her. She does half a backflip.
That's what I would have done. Like I would, the exact same thing would have happened to me.
So she makes it like all the way to the cliff, but at that point she's like at the level of the cliff and completely upside down and backwards, and she just like impacts hard and then her body just drops into this hole and she disappears. And in a one camera situation, I was just shooting from up top and, mm-hmm. and you know, down the barrel of the gun in the end run, she went flying past me and I just see her just like smack and then disappear. And it's like, oh shit. And everybody goes running. And I remember just like rallying down there as fast as I can. And we pulled her out and she was all right. She thinks she might have concussed herself, but we can't really tell if she really hit her head or not. But either way, she was definitely freaked the fuck out, as were we. And
yeah, like those holes are typically steam vents, which go form around like rocks that you're going to fall straight into and then not be able to get out. Like falling into one head first at high velocity with your skis above you and then being trapped in there for 10 minutes is one of the most terrifying things I've heard of. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Fortunately, I think she was in there for like maybe 2 minutes or something like that. Okay. Dan Marion just like climbs up real quick and kind of like shakes her. She's like, yeah, okay, okay. And like she comes out and she's all right. But yeah, I mean, that clip, I post it on Instagram once every few years. And then every single one of the Barstool Sports and other bullshit accounts steal it and repost it. And then it goes viral.
Tag a friend that would do this.
Fuck Barstool. Other backcountry shenanigans. John Sims. I believe this is from the Arraj Masters trip that you mentioned.
Sure.
But one of the, I think the craziest clip, like backcountry line clip I've seen to date in a level one film. To date meaning up until this point.
Which isn't saying a lot. Because we had almost none of it.
Sure. But he has a crazy like triple stage backcountry line that is just fucking wild.
In Norway. I mean, that dude was a very strong skier and really good athlete. And I doubt that he had little, if any, experience in that kind of terrain. But, you know, at that point, he was on this Arraj team trip with TJ Schiller, JP O'Claire,
Corey Vanuler.
I mean, just an all-star cast. And
yeah, Arraj was another company in that era that was making serious moves and doing a lot for like the scene and culture of skiing for sure, because they had hosted the Arraj Masters, which is the spring event, and then they were doing like these team trips and whatnot. But this trip to Norway that they did delivered a lot of shots that make up this film,
sure,
as well as the cover. Corey Vanler, Switch 7 Japan,
By Felix Ryu.
Yeah,
did both of you guys go? Did one of you guys go?
Neither of us went on it. The deal was that we were working with in some limited capacity with Arraj, and more than anything else, they were just keen on helping their riders get the best parts they could with us. So they offered us access to that content. I think that was probably the extent of our relationship with them.
Yeah.
And
I think that Henrik Rostrup from Teddy Bear Crisis filmed that stuff. Or some of it.
And Rod Blackhurst was shooting with an HVX. So some of the stuff was from him.
Some digi, some 16.
In fact, that shot that we're talking about, I think, was from Rod. But
That's right. 100.
Yeah. And the 16 was probably from Henrik.
Was this the same year as Teddy Bear Crisis?
It was.
Yep.
This is a big year for ski films.
Sure.
Things were happening, man.
Yeah.
Like, I just remember hanging out in Grizzly Gulch when Tanner Hall had just skied down from hitting Pyramid Gap and doing like a Switch 9 over it. And what he was doing, he was filming for his film, which was Pop Your Bottles.
Yeah.
And then he was warming up to hit Chats. For Teddy Bear Crisis. And we all know what happens there. Ankles are broken. But there was things like really happening more so than I had ever seen before, like in ski world, or at least we were like getting, it was, big things with Tanner's movie, and then Teddy Bear Crisis was one of the like milestone ski movies from that era in that year. But I mean, even Shanghai 6, I remember there's like this momentum building behind it. I remember like after the teaser dropped, it had that Rat Attack track. Everyone was like super like hyped on just like a super, I don't know, new thing. And I feel like that was when we had kind of made our mark as like, I don't know, a player more than before. But because I remember going to the meeting in Aspen and like all these people were like, yo, how's the movie? Like Shanghai 6.
Oh, it's real dark.
Yeah. It's like,
you can try to watch it. Please don't. You might not be able to.
Yeah. But it was a cool year for films for sure. Mm. But yeah, Teddy Bear Crisis, huge movie that year.
That shit's on the internet. Influence. Go watch it if you haven't seen it.
And that was like a one and done situation with some heavy hitters.
Mm. We were talking about, so you guys didn't go to Norway, but no. I believe there is an international trip this year.
We didn't go on that trip, but
we did go to Norway, just not that year, that trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mega Park.
Yeah. We went to Mega Park in Oppdal, Norway, which I got sort of invited or self-invited myself on because Forefront was going, Matt Sturbins, Steel Spence, Austin Romali, to a trip to meet with distributors in Norway. And I was like, I was in Tahoe with Austin and Luke Van Valen at the time. And I was like, you need a filmer? And I think they paid their way. And I'm very grateful to those guys for bringing me along. I guess my first trip overseas. And that was a fun time. A lot of just random stuff in that trip besides skiing. But that simultaneously was when Josh was on a European proper trip as well, France and Switzerland. And then the
level one European
the middle of the movie, like Shanghai 6 is a movie, like there's like a good third of the movie revolves around these Euro trips.
Absolutely.
The first level one, like travel segments, like
totally.
Trip segments.
And it's like straight up like tourists abroad filming everything.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. There's so many shots for one of just like the dudes walking around random streets and trains and like, you know, scenic city stuff and guys snapping photos. And, you know, it was so novel at that point that I felt it was cool to capture this, like this excitement. And it felt appropriate to put it in the movie. I mean, you can't do that anymore. But it's the same thing, like, first time we went to Japan, there's so many shots of, like, dudes walking around Sapporo and just being like, whoa,
Japan, cool. Bro.
This is a Japanese city.
Yeah. And obviously, you can do that once, like, early on. Be like, oh, yeah, this Denver segment, they're walking around Denver, like, taking photos and, like, checking out Colfax. Oh, so cool. But, but no, we were super wide-eyed young kids just... you know, figuring things out and actually talking more about Araj. So I think that whole trip kicked off with, they had a shoot/jump thing called Jumpopotamus, which was in Lock, Switzerland. And that was actually their other contribution to the movie that year is, they hooked up. It was myself and Vanular and Luke Van Valen and Craig Coker, who were all Araj riders with a condo for like a couple weeks. And I think probably the first half of the trip was shooting this Jumpopotamus jump, which was massive. I mean, it's the one clearly European jump that, I guess we go to Candide's event too.
Candide's event also has a massive,
very European jump.
Different style.
So Euro, but anyway, yeah. So we hung out in Lock, Switzerland and, it was a very good time. And, yeah, certainly ushered in a new era of us feeling like we could comfortably put these places on the hit list and actually travel to them and make level one international.
Yep.
And the soundtrack reflects it.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. There is some heavy duty bangers, like electro bangers in this movie for sure. Mm-hmm. Like Craig Coker rides to ATC all around the world, which is just a ridiculously classic. I don't know what you call it. Europop, techno banger, club banger circa 2002 or something. And then that trip that Josh filmed is from Candide Invitational and Locks is all, that's a Kylie Minogue track, Fisher Spooner remix, which is also an absolute heater. But yeah, that defines this movie. Definitely.
So speaking of
Craig, we were listening to a lot of Fisher Spooner, I think.
We were. Summer. That was huge. But yeah. On the topic of Craig Coker and this European trip. So yeah, I guess we flew from France at the time. We're going to Norway. And I had booked my ticket and I think Coker booked his ticket. We booked them separately. So we booked our, you know, US to Europe round trips and then booked a separate round trip from France to Norway and back.
The inner Euro plane tickets are dangerous with ski bags.
Well, that is the lesson we learned. And we go to check in. And I think Coker's situation was worse than mine. But
it was very bad.
$1,400 baggage overweight fee.
From flying from like Geneva to Oslo.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The round trip ticket price was $300. One way to bring his ski bag and whatever else was $1,400.
Seems reasonable.
It's a hell of a deal. Sign me up for two. And I remember like Coker wanted to cry. I wanted to cry. I think mine was like $800 or $600.
Oof.
So out of pocket, I ended up paying the whole tab. It was like probably just over $2,000. I remember first off, we were begging and pleading with this woman in Geneva. It's like, we're like in our early 20s. We're basically like kids traveling in Europe with our ski bags for the first time. Like, have some sympathy. Like, what can you do? There's a button I know you can press to make this problem go away. Like, please, please, please. And she was a lot less receptive to that begging and pleading than she should have been.
You guys are idiots. This is how we make our money. You know why that ticket was so cheap to begin with?
She's like, you know, I get 20% of whatever your fees are. It's like, God fucking damn it.
I remember you guys showed up to Mega Park.
Yeah.
Very disgruntled.
Well, we were considering throwing in the towel. It was like, is this even worth it?
That's because a huge amount of money to this day.
I don't have this money. You don't have this money. What do we do? And like, clearly, if anything, Coker didn't have like a credit card or something. It was like, this is all my problem to solve right now if I care to solve it.
You brought me here. You got to figure it out.
Come on, Dad. So I put it all on a credit card and I ended up talking Scott, his goggle sponsor. I think it might have been Kevin Cruz at that point, who maybe,
or Johnny.
Johnny Atencio. Johnny A. Yeah, it was Johnny A prior to Kevin Cruz. They offered to reimburse me for Coker's portion. And I was like, all right, we're just gonna bite the bullet and do this. And we did it. And then I remember as soon as we landed in Norway, Andre Lovas, who's a publisher,
photographer,
free fleet, wore a lot of hats at the time in Scandinavian ski media, but he's like, oh dude, you guys, like, you fucked up big time. What you do is you weigh your bags with nothing in them, you get your check-in stuff, you just like keep all of your skis and bullshit, like just unload it in the corner where no one's looking. And after they give you your bag tags, then you go put all your stuff in and then check your bags. Like, it's like, what? That's a thing. It's like, yeah. Why would you do it any other way? It's like,
damn.
Damn.
I don't know.
Information that would have been useful to us yesterday.
If we had cell phones and a way to call people, which again, yeah. I mean, that problem probably could have been solved with one very quick phone call had cell phones really been a thing. Or at least my ability to call Europe, because I know that wasn't in the cards.
Right.
But and Oppdal, Norway was awesome.
Yeah, quite a crew there. For sure. Luke Van Velen in his heyday. Classic dude, obviously.
Things have been reattached.
Yep. Stephen Thomas. Did he come to Oppdal that year?
He did. He did, yeah. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this movie has the introduction of Stephen Thomas, who's like,
he had one shot in High Five.
Yeah, he did that 450 on
the U.S. Park Open City, Rail Jam.
But he was like kind of in his early years like a jib rat for Park City, but super good style, and would progress that into a more powder and backcountry type scenarios further down the road. And then Austin Romali, who's also, I don't think we spoke touch on him too much in High Five, but he was friends with Travis Redd, so that's how he kind of popped into the crew. And he also had just like ill style. Like, I just remember shooting him one day, switch five, like, damn.
The best switch five nose in the game.
He does switch five, I believe, right hand, left nose.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Mm. Liam Downey, another classic segment from this dude. Starts off with one of the like really out of left field behind the scenes moments where he's walking on like some sort of water silo and like it's just like fucking around and then like all falls off and almost dies.
Yeah. So this year in particular ushered in the era of shooting in the Crested Butte, Colorado backcountry. We had we made a couple friends.
This is Zipper Mouth Creek backcountry. In Zipper Mouth Creek, Colorado.
Well, there's nothing left there, so it's not blowing up the spots anymore.
I was gonna say, you Google sled skiing North America, that's the first place you're gonna find. Like
Red Mountain comes up second or third, but yeah, Corey Tiblis and Ben Somrak were a couple of kids who had a production team called Two Plank Productions, based out of Crested Butte. I don't exactly recall how we initially linked up with them, but these kids gave us an open invite to come hang in Crested Butte. We've got a floor to sleep on. We've got maybe a couple couches. We've got a couple really shitty sleds, and we'll go back into the in the backcountry with you all and show you some shit. And yeah, so we went out and spent a bunch of time that spring with them. And again, it was definitely a situation where we were limited in the train we could access by how far we could tow people. Because we're definitely like looping up some rope behind these sleds and towing Downey like
with daisy chain.
Yeah, like 13 miles into the backcountry, just like arms falling off. And
with his like Senegal back basketball jersey on, that was like 4XL or something like that.
6X. But yeah, and I remember at some point, like, it was so painful for these dudes towing that Corey and Ben introduced us to some like crazy jerry rig system where you put an inner tube from a bike around your waist and then that goes. It's like, oh man, like somebody's gonna die here. But
it's a very sketchy technique.
We're gonna hang somebody by an inner tube, but their arms won't hurt, so that's cool.
Yeah, it takes takes the tension off the
until
forearms.
You drag them behind the sled for a mile, but
yeah. That's okay though. But yeah, so that was our introduction to the Crested Butte backcountry, and that became one of our go-to spots for years to come.
Again, a fruitful locale.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the easily accessible rolling terrain, a bunch of opportunities for building jumps, and a bunch of old mining structures, including this water tank, I believe, that Downey decided to climb and tried hopping off and hooks his boot on. And
which is really a sketchy moment.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
His boot buckle gets caught on the rim or like some sort of,
it's sketchy. He clearly falls off accidentally and then gets thwanged against the side of the silo.
But then like gets stuck hanging up. Yeah. It doesn't actually land on his head. Yeah.
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 Other backcountry shit in his, you mentioned that being up in Grizzly that day.
Yeah.
There's a pyramid gap hit from him too, I believe.
Yeah. So I spent a good deal of time in Utah, this winter. I sort of moved out there a little, not really, but I couch surfed for an extended period of time, but
was bunk girl, but still in the works.
I think that must have been I don't know whose house I was staying at, but
if it's not bunk girl, I don't care.
Yeah, okay. It wasn't bunk girl. That was in Park City. We were shooting Grizzly Gulch area, like many people still do. It's a great place. But that was the year that things, as I referenced, things were teeing off with those gaps. Pyramid Gap had been built early season, and it was open. It was up for grabs all spring. So anyone could hike up there and hit it, which is...
Like they just left the lip and it was...
Fully set up.
What?
We hit Pyramid, pre-built, ready to go, dust off style, butted like corn snow. Yeah, Downey got a really nice, like, sort of almost Misty 7 on that. Dope shot.
Cool rotation.
Super cool. Super cool rotation.
Truck driver?
Yeah, truck or safety. One of the two. Either way.
Looks like a truck.
Yeah, nice 7.
Yeah.
But yeah, then Tanner had done it again to switch 9, which is, like, kind of a heavy, heavy trick at that time. And we also filmed, there's in the bonus feature Snowblower, you can see a full-on rando sesh on it, which we witnessed from across the gulch. And like, I think there's a dude on Telemark hitting it. There's some heavy slams go down, but that was fully
wild.
Yeah. And I think at one point it wasn't that session, but some other crew had hit it and a kid had impacted, tried a 180 maybe by accident, landed square on the knuckle, nose to knee. And, like, exploded his face to the point where he needed full facial reconstruction.
Oh.
So there was at one point, and it might have been before we hit it with Downey, because there might have been blood on the knuckle of Pyramid Gap. Anyway, that was definitely a big year for the Grizzly Gulch gaps. For sure.
Liam's segment ends with... with him greasing a DFD to fireworks. Was that staged?
Yeah, we arranged for a New Year's Eve fireworks show in Buffalo, New York. Cost $25,000. Just wanted to entertain the city.
There's a lot of animation and stuff in this movie. I don't know.
It's funny. We could have definitely faked that.
Neil could have composited those in.
Easily for cheaper than the 25 grand that we spent on that show. But no, in reality, that was New Year's Eve of 2005. I had been with Downey and Corey Vanler in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario. Myself and Jeff went in shooting photos. And we were just on the tail end of our stint up there. And we're moving on, looking for more zones. And drove across the border into Buffalo, where things were considerably drier and colder and shittier. And we spent the day just kind of moving chunks of ice. And
gotta love it.
Liam got a shot on it was basically two down rails with like a kink in the middle with a gap that was, in retrospect, it was pretty sketchy, but kind of cool.
I can't see it because it's so dark, but yeah.
But it was there. It was sick, I promise. Sure. And then we moved on to this, was that a down flat down or a down rail? The fireworks.
Oh, the firework. Okay, that's why I thought I was wrong about that, but the fireworks, I'm pretty sure, is a DFD.
Okay, yeah.
Two separate rails.
No, those aren't two separate rails, but I'm just saying. We started on one, then moved to the other, and it was getting right into midnight, and like a lot of those rails with no natural speed at the time, it was a challenge. And I mean, what could have and should have taken somebody like Liam two tries to get, took many dozens of tries, and we're going up into midnight, and then as soon as the fireworks show kicked off, all of a sudden Downey stomped this thing, and we're all excited, and we're just like, oh man, cutaways, B-roll, let's go. And like everybody like runs up to the top and got a bunch of shots of like Downey like walking towards the camera with the fireworks in the background. We were just scrambling. And New Year's Eve. It was cool too, because that trip was the first time where we had two street crews actually going after it once. So we'd split up, divide and conquer. I was with those guys initially in Niagara on the Lake and now in Buffalo, and Frieda was up in Ottawa with the Canadians.
Yeah, that's right. That was the first trip of the season. I went up there like, must have been right around Christmas with, at first it was Jeff Winterton, myself, David Crichton, who was kind of hosting the whole thing. I was staying at Crichton's house, and Scott Hibbert as well. And maybe Liam was there as well. But then Liam and Winterton went down to join up with Berman later on. But Ottawa, great street city. But it was also kind of the first time I had shot street with Dave, and he was kind of like on a, like almost a comeback year, it's like in a way. Because High Five year, he has a part in High Five, but
it doesn't compare to the Forward part. It
does, right. So he like came out in Second Generation, and then Strike Three and Forward, he has like
bangers.
Bangers, like just absolute like
highlights of the movie.
Cast in gold bangers.
Yeah. And High Five,
it's like a lot of that backyard stuff. He does like a switch nine and a chemo and the quarter pipe, but he had been struggling with Crohn's disease. So that was kind of throttling his skiing a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was trying to find different ways to treat that so he could be like a regular functioning human being, let alone freaking athlete.
Right.
But coming back into the shooting for Shanghai 6 here, he was feeling good. And I was like, damn, I'm on like a full on, I'm staying with Dave. I'm on a street trip with Dave. He's like calling the shots, like, let's fucking go. And we went, we hit like many, many spots. I remember just starting to think like in my head, which is I hate to think this way, but I was like, dude, we already got like 8 shots in the bag or something. Like, this is going to be like a new era. Like, Dave Crichton is back. Like, and I was just like, hey, we're getting it like every single day. And, we were just on one. He was on one, you know, things were happening. I remember like one night we were shooting this quad kink. It was minus 40, which was when Celsius and Fahrenheit meet at the bottom. And he slides this quad kink like left foot forward, so unnatty at the time. And the tripod was like frozen. So there's a little hiccup in the shot. I remember being absolutely gutted by that. But there's nothing you could do. It's fucking cold. I got serious frostbite on a couple of my fingers that night.
You can see that little jump still. Like, we actually did some work to try to fix it, which was pretty rudimentary at the time. I think with 2019 technology and know-how, we could make it look a little better. But I mean, it was fine. It was really fine.
It's like, whatever. Yeah. But
shit happens.
Pales in comparison to what happens on New Year's Eve, where Dave, Garrett Britton, who was shooting photos, and I went, maybe Herbert was there too, but I think it might have been just Dave and Garrett and I, New Year's Eve, go to the, I guess it's the Arts Monument in downtown Ottawa, and he's hitting a street set. Like, basically,
let me point something out. Yeah. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that was the first time he had ever skied on his pro model ski.
Yeah, that could be right. He just gotten his pro model.
I'm pretty sure
that's
the case.
From Dina Star.
Hmm.
That specific day. Anyway. Yeah.
It was New Year's Eve. I know that. And we go there. I mean, he definitely was on his pro model that night.
And that, that was it?
Yeah.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah. Just hitting, like, I don't know, skate style, jumping off down a stair set, and did a couple of straight airs. Does a 180 shifty, stomps it, and skis right into a signpost very fast.
Mm.
And kind of like folds into it neck first into the post.
Mm.
It seemed like it. The crash is in the movie, but it's very like brief, and you can't really tell what's going on.
This is nighttime too, right?
This is nighttime. This is like probably at 11 p.m.
And all the lights are on the
December
feature,
31st,
not on the runout.
Yeah, we had like construction lights
right
running off at Jenny. So, at first it was like whatever. He just hit a post back going backwards pretty fast, but then he was like, "Oh fuck, really hurts! It really hurts." Oh man, we got to go to the hospital right now. Let's go. I'm just like, okay. I mean, he's walking around. He's fine. Or he seemed fine. So it makes me sick to my stomach talking about it. But he like, we go to the hospital. We go to the ER. I'm in the Canadian ER in downtown Ottawa on New Year's Eve. I remember the ball dropping and whatever on TV. And we're sitting in the waiting room for the ER. Shit. He goes in, I think they're like, yeah, I need to do an x-ray. Gets the x-ray, and he's like, well, good news and bad news is, like, bad news is you broke your neck, which is, like, fucking a horrible thing to hear.
Yeah.
And it's like, good news is there's no surgery that needs to be done or anything. You're fine. You have a piece of, like, chipped vertebrae, and you just need to wear a neck cast for the next whatever period of time.
Mm-hmm. 8 weeks.
So he walks out of there. Dave and I walk out of there. He's got a neck brace on.
Yeah.
It's just like, we go back to his house at 2 a.m. and we're just like, yep. Well, that's the end of that. And I mean, this is right before X Games. All these things that like he was going to do, like all these hopes and dreams kind of like shot out the door and
on like a fluke crash.
And he's like, on a fluke crash, man. Fluke. And like, it was the first crash where it had more serious results that I had maybe ever seen. And I was very intimately there. It was just Dave and Garrett and I. So if it hit home, it was like a dagger, you know? And not only that, I was just fully invested in seeing Dave come back, you know, like to return to form, so to speak. So he was just like, yep. Well, that's the end of that. And like, I'm just probably going to go see a specialist and see if they need to do anything more. And I was like, well, I'm going to drive home. Yeah. So I just like couldn't, you know, that was it. Like, and I drove home at 3 a.m. I remember crossing the border in northern New York or something like that at 5 or 6 a.m. New Year's Day and just being like in a fog, man. And then, I mean,
Trips over, fam.
But that was kind of like the end of Dave in Level One movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just saw someone on New Schoolers the other day, like, talking about his forward segment and being like, yo, what the fuck happened to this dude?
Yeah, I mean, that's
And someone responded being like, oh, he just, like, went into real life shit.
Which is true, for sure. And I think he had a family that was super, like, kind of pressuring him a bit to enter the real world. You know, he had his
very smart, educated, successful family and siblings.
Yeah, all his brothers had, you know, gone to advanced degree stuff and were doing stuff, and he was still pursuing this like freestyle ski career, which obviously was still like popping off, and he had yet to reach his full potential, in my opinion, for sure. But you know, he made waves either way. He made massive waves either way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, level one has a lot to credit to him. But it was just a devastating way to go out on top of battling Crohn's, which, I think he's done really well at since then. Got, I think that breaking your neck is like one of those things where it's a kind of like you rethink everything.
Yeah.
That's when you're like, do I really want to do this anymore? Maybe not. And right. He still loves skiing, man. He skis a lot. He moved out to Whistler one season.
Word.
We went That's back to Ottawa. Kyle Decker, Henrik Erlow, Phil Kaspan, JF Hull, and I went back to Ottawa in the early season of 2008, 2009, rather. And he kind of like tour guided us around. And it was like, dude, Crichton was like,
legend.
Like, total legend, but also like had been sniffing out. Like, he didn't miss a beat, dude. He'd been sniffing out all these spots. Some of them were like loco. He's like, yeah, dude, just bring out an angle grinder. We'll cut that like shit off. Like, or, like, yo, I don't know, man. Like,
See, I would have done it.
Yeah, like, oh shit, dude. But yeah, he's still super on point, and I know he's still like loves skiing and all that. So, but that just was like a really just like fluky ass fucking night and a fluky moment. And it was a bummer. What else? What can you do?
That post was like, what, a half inch thick?
It was nothing. Like, it was like a street sign, like not a heavy duty thing.
No. And like, you look at the clip and it's like this crazy, like his skis catch. He's going out the outrun switch, skis catch on concrete or the pavement. And he just kind of like stutters and leans back, and it's the kind of thing where his head just impacts this thing directly. It could have been 6 inches to the left, 2 inches to the left or right, and just like grazed his head and like messed up his collarbone or something like that. And I mean, that would have sucked too, but it was just this crazy fluke. I mean, everything is a game of inches.
Yeah Damn.
Yeah,
respect, DC.
Yeah, respect for sure.
The best.
Yeah.
I mentioned it before, I'll say it one more time real quick, that there is no other athlete that at any given time in their career was the best street skier, the best park skier, and the best pipe skier. That is something that's entirely unique and exclusive to Dave Crichton.
Yeah, I mean, he had missed winning X Games. I don't know if we talked about that, like the year before, by a mere binding release on a 1080 at the bottom of the pipe.
Yeah.
Would have put him on the podium, at least.
Yeah. Well, he was doing flat fives at that point that were like 5 feet above everybody else's biggest hit.
Yeah.
Ugh. Next level.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of multidimensional, one more person to talk about, I think. Steele Spence has the ender. And we were talking last week about how he had really gone in on the backcountry thing early, had learned how to gotten a sled and learned how to sled early. And I think it's really fucking cool that having invested in that, he's still out here greasing really sick street rails.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he was one of the first guys to be super well-rounded and being able to handle backcountry POW situations and street, which is two very unique skill sets. I mean,
wildly different skill sets.
Like, yeah, and knowledge bases and everything.
Exactly.
That comes
That's
with
what
it.
I'm trying For to sure. say with that. For like sure. it's more than just the skiing there. It's everything you're doing around the skiing that gets you into that spot.
Yep. Entirely. Totally. Entirely. I'll tell you, it's funny watching his part. I definitely reminisce about that era because he was my roommate in Aurora and one of my best friends. And then Travis Redd was one of his best friends and in turn also one of my best friends. And I mean, that was one of the times where I felt very strongly that I was a contemporary of the athletes that I was shooting with still. And that didn't last for too many more years because the reality is that most of the athletes we're shooting with are, late teens to mid 20s on average, late 20s. And obviously the game is changing as we continue to age ourselves. And some of the guys that we're working with are still the best in the biz in their late 20s or early 30s. But certainly at that time, that was the case. And there's so many situations where it would snow 6 inches and we just kind of wake up in Aurora and just be like, all right, guys, cool. Let's put the drop-in ramp on the trailer and go shoot some rails 5 minutes from here. And we go out and shoot and come back like 4 or 5 hours later. And it's like, all right, cool. Let's just wait for it to get dark and then we'll go to the school. And then we'd go out and then, there's no other time or place where, Well, I guess a couple years later. But it was definitely a very unique situation. And that was the first time I'd really experienced that where, you know, we were pretty much family with the athletes. And I think watching some of the funny stuff, like the level of comfort and just like interaction between myself and some of the guys, like, is just really clear, especially like Travis's part. I mean, they feel like they're joking around in front of the camera the same way they're just like joking around with their friends, and there's no filter. There's nothing. And, I mean, that definitely is something that stood out to me watching their parts.
I continue to think that the humor in these movies plays a really big role in, differentiating them and creating a vibe and conveying the homie shit, like you're talking about being tight with these dudes. And
yeah, there's some shenanigans, and we were putting them in, like, as a decision.
Right.
You're including
totally.
That
and
stuff.
Clearly a very deliberate decision was to make the intro to the very, well, if you watch it digitally, it'll be the intro to the movie, but if you have a DVD, it'll be the pre-roll to the DVD menu is you guys fucking around with a fire hose somewhere. What was going on there?
So that was Luke and Coker and I at the Candied Invitational. We were all roommates, and Candied put all the athletes up in this probably like 1970s hotel. And I don't know if it was Coker or Luke noticed that the fire hose that was right outside of our room was highly functional. And it wasn't like behind some glass cage or something like that. It was just an actual hose with this huge wheel you can turn to like get the water flowing at like 5,000 PSI or whatever it was. And
it really is like a higher end garden hose, because it's not crazy, right? They're not like blasting, like a real fire hose would blast you across the room.
For sure. I saw it on YouTube a couple of days ago, actually. Yeah. A real fire hose will fuck you up.
Yeah,
but
like take the skin off your body.
Yeah, but this was not, this was a lot more than a garden hose. In fact, like watching
or like, that's what I mean, like not a garden hose, but like a three times garden hose.
Yeah, it was. It was powerful. There's a lot of water coming out of there. But I forget the genesis of this one initially, but I don't know, these guys thought it'd be hysterical to like make this little skit where Luke gets Coker with the fire hose and then Coker gets him back, and Luke's like, yeah, I can be sitting on the shitter and like Coker can open up the door. And if you actually watch it, there are a number of takes in order to get these shots, because it's like this reverse cut, like from Luke's POV back to Coker. And like, so Coker just went the extra mile in every single take, unloaded on Luke, like way above and beyond what was really required to like get the point across.
Yeah.
I mean, just like no holds barred there. And I mean, they were like, hundreds and hundreds of gallons that just flooded our...
Dude, yeah, there's so much water in the bathroom and out in the hallway. Like, what happened to the water?
It went through to the hallway in the room below us.
And did anyone, like, say anything?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, I was like, did this just go unnoticed?
No.
Oh, my God. Oh, so you guys did get...
No, I think after that, we just split. And I don't think that they were, well, we didn't like check out split, but we just like closed the door and like walked away and like went out and had dinner or something that. And I don't remember exactly what happened. I know we didn't get in trouble, but I definitely remember somebody asking, and maybe Cooker's like, oh, I left the shower on or something like that. I didn't close the door, or the bidet exploded or something along those lines.
It's always the bidet.
Oh man. But, sorry about that, Candied. I hope you didn't get the tab for that one. But that was good times. Good times. And we shot this thing like having no purpose or end goal. It was just like, we're just going to shoot it because it's funny. And and I don't think it fit in the context of the movie. And we're like, I think we had some sort of obligation to do a pre-roll for Free Skier. And we're like, oh man, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it.
They wanted a video ad.
Yep.
It could be anything, I guess.
So it came up with that copy, Don't Get Hosed.
Yeah. You could be, yeah.
Yeah.
Agencies are calling, Berman.
This great idea involving a fire hose and.
Well, that's about all I got. You got anything else you want to chat about? Should we call it?
I think we can call it, man.
All right. Yeah. Let's get out of here on a Friday.
Get out of here Friday.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Word See up. Ya. Thank you, Connor.
Mm-hmm. That was episode 6 of Level 20. Appreciate you tuning in. Make sure you tell your friends if you enjoyed. Share the movies with them. They're going to be online all summer long. Go pre-order Romance. Go buy a new fleece. Support independent filmmaking. Rate us on iTunes if that's your thing. And we will see you next week for episode 7. Long story short. Cheers, y'all.